The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversations. This week we're going to be looking at sensitivity or being sensitive, and I am joined by Dr. Alex George. I noticed on your thing that you're trademarked at Dr. Alex. I love that.
I have to be, because people try and use my name and attach it to things, which is what which worries me as a doctor. So hopefully,
but it's pretty cool. It makes you sound like a superhero, I think.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I like it.
Like Marvel, TM. I don't know.
Yeah,
about that.
Exactly.
I'll take that. Thank you.
Alex is, I mean, you're many things. You're an A&E doctor, an ex-Love Islander, but even those two colossal things don't even do his career justice. He has become known for his honesty and insight around mental health, physical health and well-being. He was appointed the Youth Mental Health Ambassador by the government in 2021, which is wild. And he created a Children in Need documentary, Our Young Mental Health Crisis, which aimed to shed light on children's mental health. He's written one Sunday Times best-selling book, and he's about to release his debut children's book, A Better Day, which we'll be chatting about in due course. What a massive list of achievements.
Oh, thank you, Clammy. Thanks for having me on the podcast as well. I think you said that being wild. It was wild, I think you said, that I got the role. I'm not here to be described as
it's big, isn't it? It's government.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I guess wild is probably actually a very good way of describing the experience. But yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And, you know, especially with this book, I mean, speaking to you, you're kind of one of the OGs, I think, talking about, you know, I guess parenting and the challenges of you know, that children face in this time. And I think sensitivity is a very good topic for us to be talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, it really resonated. I've been reading your book, and I too am, or was, and still are, a sensitive person. And I'm really surprised at my kind of guttural reaction to when you talk about being called sensitive. I wince. When did you first become aware that you were sensitive, and how did, was that relayed to you, and how did you feel about it?
Well, I think I since I was very young, since I can ever remember, I always felt other people's emotions quite a lot. I think I've always been quite aware of other people at school. You know, I can remember, you know, if someone was like the butt of a joke, then I could like really feel their pain. And sometimes I just found that even watching things on TV, if I saw someone suffering in any way, that like really seemed to affect me more than I thought other people around me, or at least that I saw. And I thought, gosh, does it make me weak? I don't know. It was, I guess, a confusing time as you're growing up. And I guess as well, I really noticed it at school when people made, say, jokes about me, and it went through a period of time where I was being bullied. And I think I was bullied because I was sensitive. I think a lot of people who kind of allow things just to bounce off them and don't react, you're not giving the bullies energy. But if you're sensitive, you kind of, they feel that it is getting a reaction. It's like, you know, red rag to a bull, I guess, in that sense. It took me a long time, probably into my adulthood, to really realise that being sensitive is actually a bit of a superpower, and I see it that way now. And I think most of the things that I've done have been off the back of the fact that I am able to relate, that I'm an empath, that I'm sensitive, that I can be aware of other people around me, and I don't see it as a weakness anymore. And I think that's important to learn, you know, what are your strengths and strengths and perceived weaknesses, and how can we utilise not just our strengths, but use what we perceive as weaknesses as strengths, So, you know, as I was growing up, being tall, I hated that. I really hated being tall. I wanted to be hide away as much as I could. I hated being sensitive. Now I think my favourite physical attribute is the fact that I'm tall, and my favourite, you know, personal attribute is the fact that I am a sensitive person. I really can, you know, feel what other people are feeling, and I care about other people deeply.
I think you're so right with that. It's so often the case that the things that we think are our weaknesses become our absolute superpower. And I do agree about the sensitivity being a superpower. I know that feeling so well. I have it with my husband, who is the opposite. He's very like happy-go-lucky, and we'll go to a party and I'll be like, oh, and this person's vibe is this, and this person's this, and this. And he was like, what are you on about? I was like, oh, I just felt what everyone was feeling in that room, and he just can't comprehend it. But I'm sure you understand exactly what I mean by that.
I think it's an interesting way of putting it, actually. And people, we often think of sensitivity as like, you know, oh, we're sensitive, or someone says something that upsets us, but it's also just the ability to feel energies. You're right, in the room, like, whereas other people walk in and kind of bounce around the room and it just kind of don't pick up on those things. I think as a HSP is kind of coined now, isn't it? Highly sensitive person. You're able to kind of feel that energy, and you feel I think you feel almost connected to everyone around you without even maybe knowing people sometimes. You can kind of get that body language off them. I mean, you know, 90 to 95% of our communication is nonverbal. You know, so much of it, if we take that, then if you are someone that's, you know, sensitive and you're able to kind of feel what people are expressing, or, you know, read people, I guess, in that sense, then, you know, it really is a skill. And I think it is a superpower if you can harness it. But it does require an ability to adapt the way that you deal with it, I think. You know, when I was younger, and I think this is a big point of why I wrote this book, is that, you know, it's about learning to develop the tools to control and manage, you know, characteristics like this. You know, because if you're really sensitive and you allow that to go, you know, to dial up and be switched on all the time, and you know don't manage your sensitivities, you're just a wreck all the time, because you're ebbing and flowing off other people's energies. You're going up and down like a roller coaster. Whereas if you can kind of learn to manage that, manage your thought processes, learn, you know, to practice mindfulness, learn also when to ignore some of our sensitivities, then that's when you can switch it on and off and actually use it as that superpower.
Yeah, you're so right. In fact, that's something I'm really learning as I get older, especially as a female, especially being hormonal. I know that when I am being extremely highly sensitive, and in fact, I had an interaction last week and I was able to say, look, just give me some boundaries here, because I know that I'm feeling it, not more than I ought to, but I'm feeling it very strongly, and I have to kind of let my body just adjust to that. But it that is a learning, isn't it? Of otherwise you're going to burn yourself out, because you're just absorbing things all the time. And I'm wondering for you, I mean, you're an A&E doctor, you are in a room full of people in crisis. How on earth do you put some boundaries in to protect yourself from that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I up until a year ago, I worked pretty much full time in A&E, particularly throughout the pandemic. Now, actually, I've not been in A&E for nearly a year because of my focus around mental health work. And, you know, actually, we'll come on to burnout in a little bit, because I think that plays into this, and you actually mentioned it there. You know, yes, it's interesting to me, because when I was younger, I never thought I'd ever be able to work in A&E in an environment where people are suffering around you all the time, and be able to kind of, I don't know, cope with that, because, you know, I was sensitive after all. But actually, again, it goes back to that point. When you learn how to switch it on and switch it off, create boundaries, how to deal with it when you're actually finding things too much, again, it's a real superpower. I find that, you know, in A&E, I generally get on with 95% of patients, if not more than that, because I feel like I really try to relate to them. And the sensitivity, I think, does allow you to relate to families, to engage with them, to show genuine care and compassion. Because, yeah, being an A&E doctor is so much about the knowledge, the skills, the clinical side. But a lot of it as well is being a human and being someone that people can trust. Because ultimately, we always say we get 90% of the diagnosis from the history. So what people are telling you. People only tell you things that they trust you in general. And a lot of the time you're asking people to talk about very sensitive or difficult topics, feel comfortable enough to do that. So if you're able to make people feel comfortable and safe in that environment, then you're going to get more information, which allows you to make that diagnosis. Whereas if you're not very good with people, or people don't feel safe with you, you might not get the key information you need to make a good diagnosis. So again, in that sense, it really is a superpower. It allows me to do my job. throughout the pandemic, I mean, let's be honest, it was hard a lot of the time. There is an element, I believe, of numbing that happens as you work in a hospital. You know, the first death is always the most, you know, not always actually, I've seen some things that are particularly difficult, but you know, when you see death for the first time, it's really shocking. Would I say that I'm as shocked by death now? No, of course I'm not. And that's not being throwaway, but you know, you have to learn to create those boundaries and those barriers that we talked about, and you have to protect that space. Because ultimately, if I was an emotional wreck every time someone died, I wouldn't be able to come out of that cubicle and go and look after the next patient. And I wouldn't be doing the next patient justice. So there is a balance to be found. But you do have to recognise when things are tough. And throughout the pandemic, when we're having days where there's so many people passing, I mean, you know, you really had to step back and go, wow, this is heavy, this is a lot. You know, post-pandemic and the post-pandemic world, we're now seeing the fallout from all the staff. I mean, people are leaving the NHS in their droves. You know, lots of people at medical school, actually seen a lot of medics, students actually pulling out now before they even graduate because they're afraid of what they're going into. And I think we need to really recognise the kind of traumas that the pandemic has done and how the landscape's changed. Because working in A&E now is not the A&E that I joined. You have to wear masks all the time. You know,
still.
Yes, you do. I mean, you know, we talk about that, like, safety and making people feel comfortable. The first thing I do when I go and see a patient, I smile at them. I give them, you connect with the eyes and with your expression. Mm-hmm. If you've got a mask up to your eyes, you're removing most of your ability to express and to connect. And even that, it's just, there's so many things now that have changed and will remain changed that it's a completely different world. It's completely changed.
So much of the kind of humanness, I guess, has had to be taken away from it, hasn't it?
Well, when everything kicked off, weren't allowing, you know, family members in at all. You know, we were scrambling for phones and iPads to let people say goodbye to their loved ones over an iPad. You know, and that's very difficult and infinitely difficult, obviously, for the family and for the patient. It's not great for us either. You know, it's not the way that I want to, because death is, you know, death is a part of life. I think in British culture, for some reason, I think more than any other cultures, we kind of avoid death and we don't think about it. But, you know, what do they say? The two things that are guaranteed in life are taxes and death. You're going to die somebody, right?
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And the beauty of life is that we do die, because living forever would be boring, quite frankly. You know, you've got to have, it's the kind of, death gives you that ability to live in the moment as much as possible, doesn't it? It's always that fear of when it will end that gives you the joy, I think, of each day. And I think as Brits, we're just really bad at dealing with death. We avoid it, we ignore it. And then when you have a situation where, you know, it's bad enough as it is and you can't even say goodbye to people in the way that you think you should be able to, horrific. Really, really, really not great.
You're so right about what you're saying as well. There's only two moments in my life where I have that real clarity where I understand what it is to exist. And one is post-birth with my kids, and the other is in extreme moments of grief. You know, you have that very, very real sense when you feel like the world has shifted on its axis and you're like, oh, I get it. I see what life is. And then in time, that goes away from you in some way. But there is an unbelievable clarity that comes in those moments, isn't there?
Well, it's funny, and I'm just looking at my phone because I was talking to Holly, as my social media assistant, walking in, and I saw this quote last night, which is kind of funny that we're talking about this. The word is memento mori, and it's a symbolic trope, apparently, acting as a reminder of the inevitability of death. So it basically translates to remember that you must die, which I think people would take as extremely negative. Oh my God, that's a horrible quote. But I think it's an amazing quote because surely the beauty of life is that we must remember that we will die, that we, you know, those moments you're talking about, childbirth, you know, my goddaughter was born a few days ago, and you know, the things that have, those things are beautiful in life because they don't last forever. You know, like I think Ricky Gervais in The Afterlife, that famous kind of line and stuff, you know, saying that the beauty of life is that you can't replay it, you know, it just happens and then it's gone, and that's what's amazing about it. And I think definitely the pandemic has made me think a lot about that. And I think, but that's the kind of stuff, and to break, you know, I genuinely, not even just because we're doing the book promo now, but that's the whole point of doing stuff about mental health, whether it's the children's book or the adult book, because ultimately, you know, when you're younger, you often don't realise how fragile life can be. And we should be telling young kids to seize the day, to, you know, live life to the fullest, to take risks, not to fear failure, to take challenges head on, to go for things in life. Because ultimately, you know, if you live a life playing it safe, you never fail, you never lose, you never get anything wrong. A, it's a boring life, but you also never maximize or find out what you could have achieved. And, you know, I've talked about that a lot in this book because I think it's important. Kids should know that, you know, and I think we should actually, death should be part of our conversation. I talk about bereavement in A Better Day because you look what's happened in the pandemic. It's not just adults losing loved ones. Mm. Children have lost parents, grandparents. They've seen death all over the TV and social media. And I'm sorry, we will move on from death soon.
But, it's a fascinating point
because bereavement is something that transcends all generations. Mm. Yet we try and hide children from it. But we know that actually you can create real traumas and real issues for the future if you try and hide children away from the fact that they've lost loved ones. I mean, we used to... when people were dying or passing in A&E, and let's talk about this, you know, in the positive sense, a lot of passings can be very peaceful. But you know, in the situations where they were not as peaceful and things were difficult, we'd get the families out and, you know, put them in another room. But we actually know that creates more trauma than actually having them there, because it allows, having someone there allows them to kind of mentally acknowledge that they're passing, you know, and I think that's really important. That includes children, really. Obviously, depending on the scenario, but you know, children shouldn't be shielded from it. You're not actually doing them any service at all, because they're going to lose loved ones, whether it's a pet, whether it's a pet rabbit, whether it's a dog, whether it's a family member. People are going to leave your lives, and grief isn't just about death. It's about loss of relationships, loss of scenario, like moving to a different place, losing friendships. You never know like what you're going to encounter in your life, and I think if we can build, you know, these skills and these abilities as children and I guess guide children in the right way, then it really helps with this in adulthood.
I think you're so right. There's a couple of things as you're talking. Number one, I wrote a book trying to answer difficult questions from kids, and one of them was around death. And from the research I did, in fact, the witnessing of death or at least like attending funerals helps kids join those dots. And you know, it's hard for all of us as adults to process it in our own mind. But if you're not witness to any of the process, imagine someone's here and then they're not here. Is an impossible task. But I think what I was thinking is my kids ask and talk about people who have died in their life all the time, and a bit like the sensitivity, I think kids are tuned into this and then we tune them out of it, and that's the madness of it, isn't it?
Well, and I mean, this is going deep, and maybe it's not. We will get into the positive sides of it. But if you think about it this way, so I did a study at university. I was studying at university and wrote a dissertation on domestic violence in children and how children interacted or reacted to it. And a lot of the research shows that basically, if children are in another room or downstairs and they hear shouting, screaming, and banging, they actually experience a worse trauma than if they're in the room. And often a lot of those traumas and what they experience just being around or hearing things can be just as bad as if they see it or even experience it themselves. That, you know, you can try and hide children away or wrap them up in cotton wool, but actually that doesn't help. And you're absolutely right. I mean, no one lives a perfect life with no difficulty, you know, and things happen. And if we can just like gently and safely have children exposed and to things that are happening around them and not try and hide them away and you know, pretend they can't hear things or see things or feel things, then actually we're doing them a real doing them a good justice, because when they get older, it's not the first time they've experienced loss or whatever. And yeah, and it makes them probably makes them more resilient.
I think so. And actually, I'm about to move house, so my kids have had to leave their school in the last couple of weeks. And on the last day of term, my eldest, who is sensitive, was very, very upset. And actually, I really checked myself, because the maternal instinct is to try and make him feel better, and I was just like, you're right, this is really sad, and we're going to sit in this feeling. And
that's amazing, Clemmy. That's so good. I mean I'm not surprised given your background and what you've written and what you do, but that's like so many people, because you touched upon something there. Instinct, our natural instinct as human beings is to fix problems. Humans are problem solvers. That is what we are here on this planet for. That's why we're in the situation we're in now in terms of development, and also why we need to get our action together with climate change. But, you know, the point is we try and fix things. And the natural instinct, particularly a maternal instinct and paternal instinct, is, right, there's a problem here. The child's upset. Mm. They've told me that they're, you know, they're upset leaving school, or they're saying that they, you know, they're giving signs of an eating disorder, they're saying they're sad, or they're saying they're depressed. We want to jump in and fix it. But what we know is actually if you jump in and try and fix things, you often remove validation for how they're feeling, because fixing often sounds like, no, you're beautiful, don't be silly, you don't need to lose weight, or come on, you don't need to be sad, look how good your life is, look at all the things that are happening, you've got lots of things coming. And actually saying all those things makes people feel worse, whereas going, do you know what, you feel sad, that's a natural emotion. That sadness, leaving school and going to somewhere new is sad. Doesn't mean that there won't be happiness as a result of what we're doing. What we're doing is wrong, but it is sad. It's like leaving a relationship. You know, whether you leave a relationship because, you know, it, depending on the scenario, but if you leave a relationship and you go, right, this is the right decision for me, it can still be really sad. You know, and just trying to patch that over and just trying to press down that emotion, which is what we often ask men to do, actually just causes so much more damage than we just recognize it. And, you know, if, and I always say to, I talk to a lot to parents and teachers as well about, you know, dealing with situations where a young person is talking about an eating disorder or whatever. And the best thing you can do is just go, do you know what? I'm going to listen. Just tell me what you're feeling. What is it you feel? Validate what they feel. Don't say, you're beautiful, don't be silly, all these kind of things. They're natural things to say. We've all felt that urge. You want them to feel better. But if you just listen and go, do you know what? I hear you. I don't have all the answers. I'm not saying I can make you feel better straight away, but I hear you. That's the most powerful thing you can say to a young person, because they feel validated, they feel listened to. And that's where the signposting comes in. And as family members, as friends, as colleagues, it's not our job to fix people. You know, we can be there and hold their hands and take them to the people that can. You know, and I think that's a distinct role that we have to be careful with. And it's difficult. I think the messages at school when we were younger, you know, especially as boys, like, big boys don't cry, man up, grow some balls, don't be a girl, all these kind of really quite deeply, not just damaging, but quite sexist, kind of but very commonly used phrases that were told to us. I mean, think how damaging that is. You know, I remember falling over and saying, don't be, come on, man up, you know, don't cry, what's wrong with you? That is just, it's drilling down this don't show weakness that comes. Don't show sadness, don't show emotion. And then we're surprised when 50-year-old men can't even talk about how they feel.
No.
You know, if you break down why, you know, 10 times, men are 10 times more likely to take their own life than women, it's actually quite simple. It's because we keep telling them not to show emotion. Mm. So surprise, surprise, they're not going to ask for help. No. So we have to, like, you know, you look at 40, 50-year-old men now, we have to go through 40 or 50 years of unlearning deep-rooted things. You know, what we learn in children is deep-rooted. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's some deep stuff. It's a lot of work to unwind that. But we have a real opportunity, and I think that's why I feel really positive. And that's why I feel positive about this book, is because for the next generation particularly, if we can get in there when they're young, get boys talking about emotion, validate it, show that crying is a sign of strength, that actually I truly believe we get in at the right age, particularly, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old up, if we really focus on that age group, as they get older, I really believe we will see a huge shift in what's going on right now. And I hope we'll see those suicide rates coming down, because men will talk, they'll ask for help. And actually, a mistake we make, I think, is that we keep saying about men talking to men, and we keep kind of taking women out of the equation. Women are... I would love to, well, I wouldn't love to, I'd hate to meet someone, but I would love to hear an example of a woman who doesn't have a man in their life they care about, whether it's a son, there's a brother, a friend, colleague, father, whoever it is, there's someone you care about that's a man, right? So you're going to care about supporting men's mental health. Mm. You have a responsibility, actually, to support men's mental health. And if we're saying, like, women have been brought by society to talk more, to be better at this, why are we not engaging women with men? Why don't we have the conversation being broader, going, right, how can women engage with men to improve their conversation around this? How can they approach men and get them talking about mental health? And that takes the pressure away from men's feet, basically. I think that's an error that we're making. We're actually excluding a whole cohort, literally half of the population, who are actually pretty good at talking. Then, you know, we're all learning. No one's perfect around it, and there's other issues that we have to work on. But let's get women talking to men about it as well. Mm. You know, get the husbands talking about mental health. It's not just about men talking.
No, it's everyone so true. And also, then you're trying to get a whole group of people who have got perhaps further to learn in this, trying to help each other, and that is really difficult. It is more natural, we know it, you know, you have, if you had a group of women going out on a night out and a group of men, and you come back and you go to the guys, well, what did you talk about? How's this going on with someone's life? Not even covered it. Girls have covered the whole lot as a default. So you're right. But I mean, these young boys, I do hope that's changing, because if there are many versions of my son going home and not having that being said to them, oh, man up, and then they're not then repeating it in the playground, hopefully it will change. But what you teach them is that being sad is something to be scared of. And yeah. And it's just what I do know from the work that I do is that all emotions are equal, you know.
Exactly. I mean, all emotions have their place.
Yeah.
They're not even just equal. All emotions are important. Imagine if someone died and you weren't able to experience sadness. I mean, it's a weird. So that energy is going to go somewhere. Mm. Does it go into anger? Does it go? Because that was what happens, right? If you look at a lot of, you know, it's a stereotyping, but you know, men typically, they talk about, oh, if they're upset, they get angry, and agree dealing grief with anger. I think that's actually because you're suppressing sadness, and therefore the energy must come out somewhere. It's like a kettle boiling and trying to stop the water coming out. Something's got to give. That steam needs to come out. It's got to go somewhere. And sadness plays a really important role. And actually, if you think about it, when you cry and you're sad and you physically allow tears out and you cry, you feel better afterwards.
Amazing.
And that's no coincidence, because it's quite literally our brains and our minds processing what's sad and allowing that energy to dissipate in tears. And
so cool, really.
What I think will help, but I think is helping, is we are seeing more male role models being sad, talking about things like, you know, sadness and grief, crying, you know, showing that. And I think there's a real strength in it, and I think for young boys growing up, if they can see other generations and people they aspire to being open about it, they'll do the same. They will do the same. But I have a feeling of optimism. I think the world is changing fast. You know, so we are in the middle of a mental health crisis. You know, there's 500,000 children at the moment on the waiting list for child and adolescent mental health services in England. So that's, what is that, about 6 Wembley stadiums full of children. Wow. So we've got to look at what's the solution. You know, a lot of people go, right, let's chuck, you know, billions into mental health services like CAMHS, right? Let's chuck billions into there. The issue is the way that we develop mental health services in this country is that those services, those CAMHS services, as we abbreviate them, was designed for about 5% of the population that are struggling. They're only designed really to deal with people who are really unwell, who are kind of really advanced in the stages of the mental illness, okay? There's a huge bunch of people, and in fact, a large proportion of those people on the waiting list that won't benefit by being seen by CAMHS. Mm. So even after they wait a year and a half, 2 years, which a lot of them are sadly waiting, which blows my mind, when they get there, they're often told, oh, actually, it's not the right place for you. And that's not because they don't care. That's because it really isn't the right place. So what's the solution? And I think a big part of that solution is got to be embedding mental health support, teaching, well-being teaching at schools, so that schools have a whole school approach to mental health. They support children while issues emerge. They don't build up into massive big problems, and also allow the community to support mental health. And that's why, you know, my role, the biggest thing that I'm trying to get at the moment is early support hubs funded. So basically embedding essentially something similar to what you can imagine a youth club would look like in the community, where you've got walk-in support for anyone under the age of 25, no referrals needed. And the idea is that they would see a youth worker who would basically sit with them, sit down, have a chat, you know, like normal human beings, have a coffee, have a chat, have a Diet Coke, whatever it is, just chat away what's going on in their lives. Find out what's happening, what are the issues they're facing, and then basically connecting them to people that can support them. So it might be career support, educational support, it might be sexual health support, it might be psychological counselling. It could be that kid is lonely. You know, we have a loneliness epidemic amongst young people. The loneliest generation in this country are young people. And so why is that? You know, we're hyper-connected to social media and we're disconnected in real life. So a lot of kids just need to be with other kids. So in that support hub, mental health treatment might look like getting them into a sports team, getting them playing music, engaging creativity. You know, we think of mental health as white coats, therapists and medication. It might be. You know, I take medication for my mental health, but it doesn't mean that that's the solution for everyone. And often, if you get in there early and you actually support that child, you make them feel heard, you make them feel listened to, and you actually engage with their life and find out what's going on, you can prevent them having a severe eating disorder, you know, or severe depression. eating disorders, a lot of that is down to control. So we saw eating disorders spike in the pandemic. They massively rocketed, you know, and it's not really that, you know, it's not really that surprising if you think that we've removed children's in all of their control of their lives. They literally have been kept at home. The only thing they can really control is when they sleep. Often they can't control that and really what they put in their mouth. So all of a sudden, there's a huge spike in eating disorders. So if you can speak to that child while these problems are starting, where they've kind of identified it themselves and they decided to come forward and get support for it, then you can kind of dig into what is actually going on in their lives. Is it things at home? Are they stressed about career? Are they worried about the future might hold for them? Are they lonely? Are they bullied? You know, a lot of people who are bullied might turn to eating disorders because they can control that. They can't stop the bullying, but they can control what they eat. So that's why I think these hubs and having that real centered approach within schools is where the money should go. You know, I need 200 million quid for 190 hubs that covers 190 CCGs or areas in England. That will help 500,000 children per year. There's 500,000 kids on the waiting list. Also, early intervention is great for the economy. So that 200 million quid, right, sounds like a lot of money. When a child's admitted to a mental health unit, to a hospital, on average, the cost is £250,000 per child, 250 grand. So that's expensive. Mental health is really expensive. And the cost of the economy. Last year, mental illness cost the English economy £90 billion. £90 billion. So there's a huge moral argument and also a huge economic argument towards early intervention to education. And yeah, a big part of that is what goes on at school. It's parents engaging with children and it's giving support services to kids when they need it early on rather than when problems are big.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There's two things as you're talking. They're kind of quite two big things, but I'll say them both and then we'll tell them. Number one, I have this real fundamental belief that it took me a long time to realise that we need to stop peddling the idea of like complete happiness. And it's something I see in your work. You can be happy broadly and still be sad. And equally on the flip, you can be sad, you can even be depressed, and there can be moments of happiness. And I think for all the reasons we're peddling this utopia, and then when you're not feeling great, and it's life. I could be on the best holiday of my dreams but still feel stressed, you know. So I think that's very important. The second one is around the kind of, which is fundamental to you, but this kind of mental health toolkit. And I think for me, I've never been on medication for mental health, but I've been at the doctors and I've been through CBT and etc. And all those things will help you, but you still, the only way you save yourself from the depths of mental health is by having access to a toolkit. And that toolkit is the things available to all of us. It is water, it is moving, it is connection. And I think we all know via Instagram that we should be doing these things, but even when I was listening to you, I forget to relate them to my children sometimes, to get them exercising, to connect them with their friends, to check they're hydrated.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, that first point, and I'm glad you raised that point about happiness. I think we're selling a false dream. You know, happiness is an emotion. It's a deflection from the baseline, as is sadness. So what is the baseline? So the baseline, I think people should be aiming for peace, being at peace with, and peace is an important point to talk about, because what is peace? Does that mean that you feel okay all the time? I think to me, peace is accepting the good, the bad, the ugly in your life, both in yourself physically and everything else that goes on in your life, and being comfortable with who you are, what your life is, and being able to sit within that. And then you can actually experience life, I think, with less pressure. And you go, do you know what? There are sad moments. There are happy moments. You know, it blows people's minds sometimes when I talk to them. I say, you know, you do realize that you can be depressed and experience happiness. Mm. Of course you can. You can be in terribly depressed, really, really depressed, but see, you know, I don't know. For example, my godchild being born. You know, someone that's extremely depressed could still see that and go, oh my God, I feel so happy. Experience happiness seeing this child being born. That doesn't mean they're not extremely depressed. Mm. So I think that's really important to kind of separate. I think peace is a much better thing to aim for. But yes, I mean, look, I wrote A Better Day because I do believe that, well, I'll stand by this and say it. I think every child should read that book. I wanted to, when I wrote this book, write a book that I wish I had when I was 10. Mm. You know, this book is designed for 9, 10-year-olds up to 13, 14. And it's genuinely what I wish I had when I was younger. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't write this book and sit down and put all the effort in that goes into writing it if I didn't believe it was essential. Because, you know, the world we grew up in now has changed. Social media, it's completely new challenges. Bullying doesn't happen just in person, it's online. And kids are trying to navigate a world where they're expected to know who they are, what pronouns that they should have, what they want to achieve in life, what their Instagram should look like, or how they should interpret the world. It's so challenging. So I put together this book with those toolkits. It's a positive book. It's a positive toolkit. And I think giving kids, before they kind of enter some of these challenges, or as they enter some of these challenges, especially in secondary school, the tools to deal with situations they're going to face will really help. There's so much in that I just wish that I'd had. Mm. And I'm proud of the book. You know, I said this to the publishers when we were doing it. I said, I want to write a book that I feel is essential. Mm. And I think if we've written a book that's essential, then I think we've done a good thing.
And yeah, and it's so true. Like, they're navigating all of that, and the answers are so simple, yet we can't access them. And it's the same as an adult. I know that if I'm in a bad spot, I shouldn't go on the internet and scroll. I know it, and I do it. And then my kids are in a bad place, and I still see them on the screen. And then actually, and that peace and that contentment that you're talking about, I know that they're happiest when they're in nature doing something pretty daft, you know, whatever, throwing stones, doing a pile of sticks, and it is available to them. But as their parents and their guardians, we need to kind of help them know when to access that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think if you can give good groundings, the fundamentals, the understanding of why is nature important? How do you actually build a good sleep routine? How do I manage difficult situations where there's turmoil with relationships in the family or friends? How do I deal with bereavement if it happens? What's the role of movement and exercise? How do I engage? If you can actually give kids that understanding, that children that understanding, young people that understanding, is that before they kind of enter those times in life, or as they're entering those more challenging times in life, they just have a better opportunity to live life healthy and happy. I mean, if you ask most parents, and I'd imagine if I asked you, you would say, what would you wish for your children? You'd want them to be happy and healthy. Right. And that's the primary thing. And not only do we realise that now more than ever that should be our goal for all children, but also that actually if you have happy and healthy children, they're also much more likely to be academically successful. I mean, it's really a no-brainer in many ways. If you look at, I find it fascinating, if you look at the countries in the world with the best or highest academic attainment, we're nowhere near the top of that. Most of that's kind of Scandinavian countries and Nordic countries. And it's not a surprise if you look at the fact that they learn through play till about 10 years old. They focus so much more on developing their social skills, their team working skills, their ability to kind of, their resilience, the ability to adapt. They're building them as people and then, you know, educating them rather than hammering them with academics and, you know, testing them to the, you know, exams. Mm. You know, how much of the stuff were you taught at school do you remember or use now? School is not about what you learn, it's how you learn. You know, at med school, I can't remember half the stuff I learned in med school. People would laugh. No, because when I start working as an A&E doctor, most of the stuff I used as an A&E doctor isn't even in the curriculum. Most of the stuff I've learned has been afterwards. And it's more, med school, for example, for me, was much more about learning how to learn, how to critique evidence, how to deal with stress, how to manage to difficult situations. And school should be like that as well. And I think if we shift our focus just a little bit, reduce that academic pressure and think more about building well-rounded people, which is what we want in society, good, well-rounded, happy and healthy people, we'll find the academic side will come. You know, one of the things I think is fascinating is that the schools that have mental health support teams embedded within them, which is one of the things I campaign for and that's been rolled out, we're seeing significantly less truancy, better behaviour in the classroom. Better behaviour means the teachers are less stressed, improves their mental health, and also means the kids are actually learning.
Yeah.
You know, because behaviour, you know, one of the first signs that a child is struggling with their mental health is that they play up. They're behaving badly, with inverted commas. So what can we do with that child? Do we punish them? Do we stick them in detention? Do we exclude them? Or do we actually dig into what's actually going on in their lives? And if you dig into that and you find out why they're behaving that way, because they struggle to express in other ways, then actually we can not only help that child, but we also improve the whole classroom for everyone else.
So true.
You know, so it's all hand in hand. And if we start thinking, gosh, do you know what? Well-being and mental health, it isn't just this wishy-washy stuff. It's actually fundamental to everything. Then actually we will really help the society as a whole. You know, it would make a huge difference. And that's what I'm excited about. I think there is that huge shift. And I think over the next 10, 15 years, kids growing up will have a completely different perspective around mental health to us. You know, and I think that is something that is exciting, actually.
Yeah. As you're talking, there's a kind of an unpopular opinion that I have, again, in relation to my own well-being. And I was on a podcast this week and they're like, oh, how do you keep yourself in check? And I said, the answers are really boring. I get up, I go to the gym, I try and eat healthy, I go to bed early, I try not to have coffee after 4 o'clock. Like, there are no exciting, easy, quick fixes. It's the same shit day in, day out. And sometimes I deviate from that and I know what happens. You know, I think, oh, I just go to bed a little bit later for a few days. And by the end of the week, my mind's not as good. And I think as a parent, there's a bit of cruel to be kind thing. We have to say you shouldn't be eating that. You should be moving. You can't kind of land happiness. Well, yeah, I don't think you can.
Well, I think if you think about it this way, you know, we could just let kids just completely, which I think is how many of us were brought up, just completely learn by making loads of mistakes. And I think there is an importance of learning through failure, of course. I mean, I talk about it all the time. But I think there's also an element of, like, let's give them a bit of a head start. Mm. Like, if we know that a good sleep routine is important, that movement is essential in each part of our day, that food actually plays a role in our mental health, and educate them the why rather than just saying, you need to do this. I think if you tell kids you have to do this, they go, oh, well, I don't do that. You told me to do it, I don't do it. But if you can actually walk them through the why, kids are very clever. They're very intuitive. And if they understand things, they engage in it and they want to do it because they understand why it actually matters. And I think that element of routine, you're right. I mean, well-being is often overcomplicated. And it's more about the challenge people have, I think, of engaging in good practice of what, you know, well-being and self-care and looking after themselves isn't what they need to do, is how they do it and building the routine. And now that's so much of what the book is really about, is about giving, helping kids to develop that and stick to it. Because you're right, you know, what I talk about is, you know, going out in nature for a walk once and just doing it today and never doing it again is going to make absolutely no difference to your mental health. But if you do that every day, together with sleeping 8 hours, together with actually generally having a reasonable diet, together with good social connections and a bit of, you know, a bit of exercise every now and then on top, all of a sudden, all those little things come together to make a big difference. I mean, and we know that through experience. You know, I know you know that from the stuff you talk about it. You know, we have built those skills up over time. But I think, and I'd say this from my experience anyway, I've got a lot of stuff wrong for a long time to find that answer. And I do think we have a duty to teach kids, you know, things that we can. Some things they have to learn through failure, right? You know, falling off your bike, you've got to fall off a bike a few times before you learn to cycle it. But if there's stuff that we know will make a fundamental difference to their lives and actually prevent a lot of problems, we are duty bound, I think, to teach them and also to guide them, and sometimes even to have discipline around them. Like you said, you know, do we allow kids just to stay up till midnight because they want to stay up to midnight? If they don't, they kick up a fuss and they cry. No, of course we don't. We know as adults and as parents, that's not the right thing for you. You know, it's like saying, oh, well, do you know what? The kid doesn't like brushing his teeth, so I'm never going to, you know, enforce brushing their teeth. I mean, that would be mayhem. I mean, everyone would walk around with rotting teeth all the time. Adults to go, mum, why didn't you make me brush my teeth? I've got awful teeth now. So, you know, there's a balance of learning and allowing learning through failure, but also going, do you know what? This is actually the right thing for your health. And this is why. And you need to stick to it.
Yeah, that's it. In fact, what I try and do, again, I'm sounding like I'm nailing parenting. I'm definitely not. But for example, my middle child has got a very sweet tooth. And there's occasions, you know, you go to parties and you want to have more sugar than you ought to. But what I do to him is afterwards just say to him, out of interest, how are you feeling now as you're climbing the walls? And try and get him just to, you know, it's not a you can't have it, and it's just a just check in with how you are. And I think I try and do that with my own like habits of when I've exercised and I'm feeling good. I really try and like log that in my mind, and I think that's something that we miss. And maybe, yeah, that is a good thing about being sensitive, is that I am hyper aware of my own being and trying to be logging those things.
I really like that because I think it's logging it in. I like that word, logging it in, and going, do you know what, next time I think, oh god, I cannot be bothered to go to the gym or go mm-hmm. for a walk, you go, but when I did that yesterday or the other week, I felt really good, and actually it was worth getting out and, you know, walking out of the house and doing it. And sometimes as well, you know, not everything that's good for us is easy. You know, I think sometimes health is made out to be kind of wishy-washy, and it's all so easy, and it's, you know, roses or whatever. But some of it's hard. You know, going to the gym is hard. You know, training is hard. Some of it, you know, a lot of it requires discipline. And I think that's very important as well, is that, you know, I've tried to shift, and I get it wrong a lot of the time as well, but, you know, I've tried to shift away from using motivation as a reason to look after myself, because motivation comes and goes. Just like happiness, it comes in waves, it goes. You have to apply discipline. Discipline gives you that kind of level baseline of like, no matter what I'm doing, if I feel good and really motivated, I'm doing it. If I don't feel motivated, I'm doing it. It doesn't matter. If you can nail that level of discipline, then the rest of it doesn't really matter. And actually then, you know, those days you think, oh god, I really can't bother to go to the gym, you go, and you get the endorphin rush afterwards, you go, oh, discipline was worth
so
it.
So true. And to be honest, what I have learned is the days I least want to go to the gym or do it is the
days you need it the
like,
most.
Oh, that's my brain. It's so mad, isn't it? Because it will trick you out of it. You can't trust your mind to do what's right for you, I don't think.
And actually, do you know what? And that's a great way also to challenge your negative thoughts. Because when your brain's saying, I don't want to go to the gym, no, I'm not going to do it, you go and you feel amazing. You go, well, you tricked me. You told me that I shouldn't go and it wasn't good for me. I shouldn't do it today, but I did and I feel amazing. You can also apply that when you're telling yourself, oh, I look ugly, or I'm this, or I failed at this, I'm really bad at this. Don't always believe your mind. Don't believe. And that's, again, something that we've got to teach kids, that you are not your thoughts.
Wow.
Your thoughts are a fictional creation. They're a movie in front of you based on, well, past events and made up, basically, you know? That's all they are. You know, I love the analogy I hear before of, like, you're at a bar. Imagine you're at a bar and you get a drink with your girlfriend, you sit down, and then, you know, she goes to the toilet, and on the way back, starts chatting to a guy at the bar, and you think, oh, my God, how dare you? She's chatting to a guy at the bar. How dare you? And you feel really annoyed, and she must be chatting with a girl at the bar. Gosh, that's frustrating. She comes back and goes, oh, it was really nice, just bumped into my cousin, Dave.
So true.
And you've completely misinterpreted that entire situation. But your brain told you that she was chatting up a guy at the bar. You know, I mean, it's such a cliched way of using it, but I think the analogy stands. You know, it's that. You know, don't always buy into what your brain tells you.
It's such a big learning.
Well, you can have two people. You know, people argue all the time. Both people think they're right. One could be right. Both could be right. Both could be wrong. You know, and it's like you're so believing, and I think it's an important skill in life as well. It's like, be careful, because actually sometimes going with your thoughts can get you in trouble.
Really,
you know, and get you in a situation where you believe something so heavily to be true that you argue, you upset people, you say something you regret, and then afterwards you find out you were wrong. And so don't always believe your thoughts. Go, you know, that I think that's a very powerful lesson to learn. You know, and also when your mind's beating yourself up and you're telling yourself you're bad at this and you're rubbish and, oh, you know, that person's having a great life, don't always believe it. Depower those thoughts, step away from them, say, do you know what? I'm not buying it.
And also, I mean, we both know this very clearly, but also speak it out loud. Because if, to use that girlfriend analogy, if you didn't say anything to her when she came back and said what was going on, you've created a narrative that becomes your truth. You just never know. And also, when you are having those negative thought spirals, so often, as soon as you've spoken them out loud and giving them airtime, you suddenly realise that there's no truth in it, but you can be stuck in that, can't you?
And I didn't even go further than that. Write it down. I think journaling, again, that's another big thing that I talk about a lot in the book, is teaching and actually teaching the reader how to, the young person, how to effectively journal. But if you write things down, a lot of the time when it's in front of you on paper, you go, you know, this is, I mean, one of the things I taught, you know, things you worry about, right, at night time, I'm sure you're similar to me, given what you've said, that, you know, you worry things. You go to bed, there's no distraction, you worry. And one of the things I find, if I'm really worrying, you can either do this on your phone or preferably on pen and paper, but write everything down that you worry. Oh, tomorrow I need to do this. Oh, God, if I forget this needs doing. Oh, what? Write it all down. Yeah. Write it all down on paper and say, right, it's written down now. It's dealt with. Is there anything on this list I can do right now or reasonably do right now? No, there's nothing I can control right now. So tomorrow I'm going to pick this list up. I'm going to read it in the morning. And if there's things on there that still worry me and need sorting, I'm going to sort them tomorrow morning. And there's this offloading process that happens, because then you go, well, do you know what? It's dealt with. I've dealt with it. I've made an action plan. It is effectively dealt with.
Yeah, it's the swirling mind.
And I think learning to... Otherwise, the swirling mind carries on and on and on. The movie, you know, carries to kind of carries and plays on. And, you know, I wish I'd have learned that stuff when I was younger. It would have saved me 15, 20 years of worrying.
Worrying about the things that never came to fruition.
The thing I was told, and I, you know, when my brother passed away, I mean, it really rang true, that the things that we worry about are not the things that ruin or affect our lives or come and bite us in the backside. It's a Tuesday afternoon when the sun's shining and you're not thinking about anything at all in the world that you get the phone call you never expected. And I guarantee you, almost always that phone call is nothing that you're worrying 100%. About most of the time. You know, I didn't walk around worrying about my brother taking his own life. No. You don't worry about those things. You just, like, I worry about everything else, this and that and that. And all of a sudden you go, oh, shit, those things weren't a big problem. Those were not big things to worry about. Let's worry about the big things. Let's not worry about it, because anything can happen, you know.
And it's so true that if I could add up the hours I've spent worrying about things that never worked out in the way, they never got to the point of worrying, because I'm projecting so far in the future. And then ironically, when the most traumatic things in my life have happened, I'm sitting here now, you have the capacity to survive. And
you can survive. Humans are unbelievable. You know, you survive things you never think that you could. And people, you know, I think, you know, I'd count myself generally, despite a few things that have happened, pretty lucky in life. And, you know, the people that still seem to experience joy, happiness and find peace, even going through even worse things, if that is possible. And I think that actually shows how amazing humans can be. But we need to learn how to deal with stuff like grief, how to manage things like sadness, and also how to get the most out of life, even when bad things happen. You know, I still believe that I've got a lot to give in life, a lot to enjoy. You know, there's some things you can't fully accept or patch up or, you know, make fit in a box, but that's fine. Like, that you learn to live with that.
I think that's a very good place to end. I do feel hopeful for kids. I do, because they've got it. They've got these skills. We're learning how to help them. And yeah, you could read the news and think that we're all doom and gloom, but there is progress being made. There is, because if you think how different things were from when we were kids, it's got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
It does. Absolutely. I think there's progress coming.
So we have to remain optimistic.
Thank you.
Two questions to end. Where can people find you? And one more shout out about the book.
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram, @DrAlexGeorge, and the book, A Better Day, is available in all good bookshops and on audiobook as well. I recorded the audiobook, which I loved. It was a really nice kind of, it's a bit eclectic, I don't know what the word is really, but it's a really nice feeling to kind of read through it all and kind of see it all together and actually experience it in a way, I guess, that a reader would. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the book, and I genuinely believe it can help people.
With your audiobook recording, I'm dyslexic. You're dyslexic, aren't you? Are you dyslexic? Yeah.
Yes.
I found doing my audiobook, though enjoy, like, therapeutic and cathartic, I found the reading out loud of it, I found recording the audiobook one of the most difficult things I've ever done. Were you okay?
I had to redo lots of bits. But then once you learn to just accept it and go, do you know what? If I have to redo this 6 times, it doesn't matter. All of a sudden you make a lot less mistakes as well. What's the worst? Read the line again.
No.
But yeah, there's certain words that come up, and I'm like, gosh. But it is. We've tried to write the book as friendly as we can for neurodiversity, because of my own experiences. And so I hope the book is as friendly as possible, whether you're dyslexic or not.
Yeah, I hope, actually, to be honest, probably written as a dyslexic, it probably is exactly that.
Yeah, well, I've written it in a way that makes sense to me, and I hope, therefore, that it will make sense to others as well. So, yeah.
But I think that's also an important point. It's like, if you and when I was first diagnosed as dyslexic, it's like, dyslexic people can't write. So we're both sitting here with people, dyslexic people who've written.
Not true. Books. It's absolutely not true. And I think, and again, not about superpowers, dyslexia is a superpower.
100%.
We are dyslexics often use a part of the brain that's associated with creativity a lot more than those that don't have that, or are not on that kind of neurodiverse spectrum. And that's a beautiful thing. So if you took away your dyslexia, you take away a lot of your creativity. What would you ever want to do that? I wouldn't. I wouldn't change it for the world. And doesn't mean you can't write a book. You just have to adapt your way of doing things. It just has to be done differently. You know, me, it's having, you know, people helping me write the book. You know, accept the fact that if I just wrote the book myself without anyone helping me, then there'd be a lot of errors. But you just bring people in. You know, the thing is, look at having your team. A good team, like look at a football team, right? A good football team will have people with different skills. Someone who's a good goalkeeper, someone's a good defender, someone that's good at passing the ball, someone that's good at striking the ball. You don't all have to have all those skills at the same time. Yeah. You know, and a big part of life, again, is learning. What are your strengths? What are your potential weaknesses? How do you adapt those weaknesses? And how do you bring other people in to help you?
Yeah, it's such a thing, isn't it? But like, yeah, I remember when I was signing mine, I was like, guys, I'm really happy to do all of it, but you're going to have a really good editor because there is going to be a lot of spelling mistakes.
Well, actually, the other thing that gives me anxiety is signing books when people ask me to write their name. I ask everyone. I say, look, I don't care how simple it sounds, spell your name. And I just say, I say to everyone, look, just spell it for me, because otherwise it's the worst thing to write someone's name. And I will spell, because you know it is, you'd write it phonetically or you write it how it sounds to you, and often that's not how names are written. So yes,
how did you cope with like medical terminology writing this?
Difficult. I don't know, you just have to learn it. I mean, to be fair, what actually one of the difficult ones, which I've just never been able to sort out, is a lot of the antibiotics all sound the same. And that is an absolute nightmare for prescriptions. And that's actually why almost all, if not all, hospitals are digital now. So you basically have to write them, because that was a nightmare for me. But it was kind of fine, because in a way, again, looking from a safety perspective, it meant that I double-checked everything. Yes. So actually, I probably made less mistakes because I was hyper aware. And that's that idea of, you know, when it comes to, again, weaknesses, being aware of your weakness is a real strength, because then you'll adapt and you'll make amendments and you'll put things into practice, I guess, to prevent those becoming an issue. If you're not aware of your weaknesses or your areas of lack of knowledge or whatever, that's what's dangerous.
No,
it's exactly the same for being a doctor. The dangerous doctor isn't the doctor that doesn't know that much but is hyper aware. It's the one that knows quite a bit but isn't aware of their weaknesses. That is the dangerous doctor.
The checking and the checking. I can only imagine, like, just check one more time.
always check. And thankfully I didn't, you know, obviously you all make mistakes, and there was one, I remember one error that I made, but it was we picked it up anyway. But I would say that I definitely didn't make any more mistakes than other doctors.
No, power to the dyslexic. Last question: if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
Well, are there people that have passed as well? So yes. Tell Theo not to be a bloody idiot and not to give up, basically. I think, you know, it doesn't matter what difficulties you are in life, even the darkest moments pass. I love the saying, this too shall pass. And I think that is something I would say to Theo.
Matt Haig has a brilliant quote, which is to stay for the person that you're going to become, basically.
Fantastic quote.
Yeah, but you can only know when you know, unfortunately.
Alas, it's life.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a gorgeous.
Thank you so much for having me.
When's your birthday? Are you a Pisces? Do you know?
15th of February, I'm Aquarius.
Oh, very nearly.
Is that close to? Is that? Yeah. I don't know. Are you?
Oh, Pisces, and they're like super emotional. But I mean, Aquarius are pretty emotional too. Ah, well, that was an interesting chat. I think my biggest takeaway from it is, of course, as a parent, I'm really concerned or prioritising my kids' well-being. But I don't think I've ever very clearly in my mind joined the dots between my own well-being habits, which sounds really wanky, but the things I do to keep myself sane, very, very directly lifting them into my kids. And I hope that a lot of that is done implicitly and also by role modelling. I hope that they know how much I prioritise good nutrition and movement and being outside. But it's definitely something I'm going to be more and more conscious of. And then the final piece, and this was as Dr. Alex was talking about youth clubs and the importance of community. You know, I grew up Although I was never allowed out, but where everyone used to go up to the local recreation ground and just knock about of an evening. My parents were quite strict and were worried about me, even though I was in a small village. But I think that it's easy to forget how important that is, and I've even seen it, and I've tried to stop it when it's happened, but my kids will have play dates and there's a temptation for them to get on screens and side by side connect in whatever world they're in, whether that's Roblox or Minecraft, and that isn't the same thing. There's a time and a place for it, but I really am going to be looking to try and make sure there's more of those moments where they're just hanging around with their peers. I think that's really important. And that's it. That's a wrap. Thank you to Dr. Alex for being a really interesting and lovely guest. Thank you to you for listening. Join me next week for more Honest Chats. In the meantime, please share the episode. Please rate and review. We're on Instagram now at ButYInsta. Get in touch on there or at ButY@ClemmyTelford. I am actually off to drink some water. We touched on it today, but of all the things I'm trying to do, I've always assumed that I was really good at drinking water because I like water, but I'm beginning to realise that I don't do as much of it as I should. So I'm going to go and have myself a pint of water and get on with my day. Wishing you a lovely day and catch you next time. Goodbye.